Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Curiouser and curiouser. That's what Alice said as she sampled the biscuits and bottles in her mysterious journey. One made her taller, and one made her smaller. Which one to choose? We're moving into an Alice in Wonderland world, as scientists make the case that on one hand, there are just too many people on the planet, while others are encouraging mothers to have more babies to serve the future. Curiouser and curiouser. Which way takes us to the future? Stay tuned. They call it birth dearth, if you can believe it, and it's being touted as a new problem in developed nations around the world. The claims? There are just too few people being born. E, the environmental magazine, takes a look at this in their current issue, which we will be exploring in the next two segments. A lot of you who are out shopping this time of the year may be stuck in some Walmart or Fry's or some other place and maybe have a little bit shopped out, and you wander over to the magazine rack. And those of us who are environmentally sensitive, you know, tend towards the nature magazines, different things, and environmental magazines. And there's a magazine that you may notice this year because it is a beautiful cover, literally. And this is E. You'll notice a great big yellow E. And it's the environmental magazine. Covers a whole spectrum of issues that relate to that concept, E, the environmental magazine. And joining us now from Connecticut, beautiful state, is Jim Motivalli. Jim, welcome to the Wild Side News. You're the editor. Talk about your magazine, how long it's been. Give us a little history.
Well, E actually is now 16 years old. I've been with the magazine 10. And we were founded in 1990, which was the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. And there was a great upsurge of interest in environmental issues at that time. And there was some of the first notice of global warming at that time. And it was also around the period where all this medical waste was found washed up on the beaches.
Yeah.
There started to be concern about how we were treating the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a huge Earth Day commemoration that year. And that's sort of what E grew out of, is that celebration then. And I was then editing a local newspaper here, but the publisher, Doug Moss, was a good friend of mine, and gradually I spent more time over here than over there, so. And I came to E, I think, in 1995 or so, around in there. And we are probably the largest independent environmental magazine. We're not nearly as big as Sierra or Audubon magazine. Those are sent free to subscribers or members of Audubon or the Sierra Club. We are an independent magazine that is able to pretty much say what we want about different movements in the environment.
Right. That's the nice thing about being independent. You can say whatever you'd like. We'll talk about the mission of E, the environmental magazine.
Well, we like to think we have an informational mission. We want people to be more informed about environmental issues. And the way we do it is by making the information as accessible as possible. A lot of environmental information is first presented as peer-reviewed science, which means that it can be impenetrable to the average reader. We basically translate that into popular science that the average person with a high school education could probably read with no problem. And all of our stories come with lots of contact information, so that if you want to follow the subject up, learn more about it, you can do that too. And we are a popular newsstand publication. We're on, I think more than any other environmental magazine, we're on Barnes & Noble and Borders newsstands. If you have a relatively large newsstand in your town, you probably can find E without too much trouble.
And then, of course, you have an online presence as well.
At emagazine.com, and if people go there, they can have a free copy of the magazine sent to them.
I use that as a source for news on a regular basis for looking for features and new topics and things like that. I rely on eMagazine, and there's a link from the Wild Side News news page to E, the Environmental Magazine.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Mm-hmm, you bet. Well, that's what I do, too. I'm trying to make sure that people have access to the broad spectrum of information that's out there. You have a nice balance of focus with every issue. And you come out every 2 months?
Every 2 months, yeah. So there's 6 issues a year.
In the current issue, which is the November-December issue, there's a topic that, quite honestly, somehow the term birth dearth, that one slipped by me, but it's a focus of this particular issue. Jim, let's get into this topic and talk about why this captured your interest and then what it actually means to the rest of us.
Well, ever since Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb in the 60s, people have been concerned that the population of the Earth was growing beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. For instance, how many people can the Earth actually support? Can we just keep growing as a species and still count on the Earth to provide for everybody on the planet? A lot of people, including Paul Ehrlich and many people since, have thought that we were giving birth to too many people in terms of what the Earth could support. And I think when Paul Ehrlich's book came out in the 60s, there was probably 2 billion people on the Earth. Now we have 6.5 billion people. And while we don't have mass starvation, except in, I would say, artificially induced, often by conflict, as in places like Darfur and other places around the world, what we have are the makings of a huge environmental crisis caused by, among other things, excessive population growth. Now, the idea of the birth dearth really refers to the fact that in most of the settled world or the industrialized world, the birth rate has been shrinking for a long time. If you look at Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia, Japan, and to a lesser extent the United States, you see that basically there is below replacement level fertility, which means that if you have a married couple, they have either 2 children or less than 2 children. Obviously, you can't actually have less than 2 children, but you can do that demographically. So that means zero population growth. If you're just replacing yourselves, you're not growing the population.
But, which is a growth rate of 2.
Right.
Two is a balance point.
Actually, it's a little more than 2. It's like 2.1.
I suppose.
And I couldn't explain to you why that is. So in many parts of Western Europe, like in Italy or Spain, the birth rate is like 1.3, 1.4, very, very low. Sweden, Japan has a very low birth rate. So these countries, which have also very low immigration rates, are in danger of shrinking dramatically in terms of their population. It hasn't happened to a huge extent yet, but that's what the demographics project is going to happen because of the aging of the population and other factors. Now, this birth dearth has been somewhat widely publicized. The point of our article, is there really a birth dearth, is to look at it holistically or internationally. And if you look at it internationally, you see there's many parts of the world where the birth rate is still very, very high. And because of that, and because of what's called population momentum, which means that if your population is very young, if you have many, many young people, the population is going to continue to grow even as the birth rate shrinks.
Lots of younger reproducers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have 6.5 billion people right now, the projections are we will have 9, 10, or 11 billion people by 2050.
It's a very complex issue in the sense that there's 2 sides to this.
The birth dearth is real. And many countries are experiencing it, and it's very dramatic for them. The United States, as I said, is a pretty complicated case.
It is.
Because while we have zero population growth, if you look at the native-born population, we also have very high immigration rates of 1 million legal immigrants a year and 2 million illegal immigrants a year. So our population is going to grow quite a bit, even while the birth rate is stagnant.
It's an astonishing number, by the way. That comes up to 3 million per year additional population.
Right. It tends to be concentrated in specific states, too, because immigrants go where there are other immigrants who've gone before. So states like California and New York see really a whole lot of immigration. Other states may not see very much at all.
And then, of course, in the underdeveloped world, it's quite a different story.
Again, it's very episodic, or depends on where you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Latin America, for instance, is experiencing a birth dearth. Many parts of Latin America are. People might be surprised to learn that Mexico, for instance, has dramatic decreases in fertility. That has a big implication for how many Mexicans might want to come to the United States in the next 40 or 50 years. Maybe there wouldn't be such pressure at the border because of declining population. I think that's probably pretty likely.
I think the complex part of this is that now I'm in California, and almost everybody that I ever meet talks about we're just too many people. I mean, we just feel there's far too many people.
Well, as I said, California is a huge destination state for immigrants.
It is. And so for us, the concept of a lowering population is something that many of us think, that's a great idea, you know. But there's this other side, which is the negative side of birth dearth, which I'd like you to cover a little bit, because I think some people may not quite understand why people would even consider that to be a negative.
Well, the main negatives are economic. If, for instance, in the United States, we're very dependent on very cheap minimum wage labor to keep our McDonald's open and our Burger Kings and our Kentucky Fried Chickens and our Walmarts. I mean, these places are run quite a bit by young immigrant labor. And if that flow decreases, you'd have pressure to raise the minimum wage and probably unionize, all the things that business hates. So I think one of the biggest forces keeping immigration rates high is the business lobby.
Mm-hmm. And as well, then, of course, you have the elders who rely on this young workforce to keep their Social Security and their support mechanisms in place, and that becomes the negative side of the birth dearth.
Right, and you have to acknowledge that in some countries where you have a real graying population, it puts enormous burden on, particularly if you're talking about a welfare state, like, say, Scandinavia. To keep those welfare states going, you really do need younger people to provide engines for the economy rather than just a very gray population that's mostly recipients of aid. It's sort of a formula for disaster.
In the Scandinavian countries, how are they addressing this then? Because you're absolutely right. They are socialized societies. Birth dearth is affecting them. What are their plans to deal with this? Do you know?
Well, not so much in Scandinavia. I haven't heard that they've really made many plans to address it. But if you look at a country like France, they have many inducements now for women to have more than two children. There are great economic breaks that you can't obtain if you have multiple children now.
Leave it to the French to come up with an idea like that.
And it's actually had an effect on the birth rate. Their birth rate is higher than it would have been, say, a few years before they instituted these changes. I mean, they still have a declining birth rate. Australia, too, has inaugurated programs to encourage women to have more children. Meanwhile, in China, for instance, they have what you might call a coercive policy to prevent women from having more than one or two children.
As we look at this interplay between the decliners and those that still are charging forward, for example, Saudi Arabia and areas in Africa, Niger, for example, their birth rates are tremendous. How does this then play out on the global stage?
The idea that we're having this birth dearth and that therefore the population issue is no longer applicable, that is beginning to get wide currency. And my point is that that's dramatically wrong because of countries like Niger, where women can have as many 10, or I think the average is 8 children for every woman in Niger, and that's combined with very poor health standards, very high maternal death rates, and as well as child death rates are very high in countries like that. It obviously does nobody any good for the birth rates to be as high as they are in Niger and in places like that. In much of the Middle East, there's still very high birth rates, and in most of Africa, That's true, too. It's also true that the United States positions under the Bush administration have been to discourage distribution of birth control, largely because they link that to abortion. And that has actually started to increase birth rates in some African countries, as I report in the story. I talked particularly about the example of Kenya, where there seems to be increasing fertility, which is very much against the norm around the world.
One of the things I found interesting in your article was that there also is, I don't exactly know how to, I don't have a term for this, but that there actually is a global fundamentalist advantage to not having birth control that is literally being discussed from the politics of religion. Help me out.
I think one of the things we're facing as a result of some societies and some religious groups encouraging very high birth rates, examples would be the Mormons, fundamentalist Islam, Hasidic Jews. These populations all encourage very, very large families. And one way of looking at it is that you would end up getting a whole lot more and larger percentage of religiously inclined people because of those high birth rates that contrast to very low birth rates in the population at large.
Well, and without treading on religious practices, because that isn't what anyone intends to do, but I think generally speaking, the world is struggling to deal with fundamentalism in all of its forms.
And fundamentalists tend to have very large families. Mm-hmm. That's generally been the case.
Well, and unfortunately, the fundamentalists are the ones that seem to be battling and killing each other right now. So there is this there's this dynamic. In some cases, some countries are struggling to say, my gosh, we have to deal with our lack of population. And in other countries, there is too much population. So there is no simple answer to this. And so I think part of the reason for you to bring this up is just make us aware of the fact that some of these discussions about this birth dearth need to really be looked at in a much more realistic and balanced way.
It's really important to say that a large part of the movement that's, say, against immigration in the U.S., that the main point is anti-immigrant, a lot of that is racist, and a lot of that should be condemned for that reason. Their main interest is to keep other races out of the United States. I would say that is certainly, in writing about population, that's never my motivation. I don't care what color immigrants are. All I care about is the number of people that are coming into the country. I do think we should have quotas on immigrants that are much lower than what we have. I think we probably should have a level of about 300,000, because I think population growth in the United States is unsustainable. It's what sets us apart from Western Europe, Japan, Russia, large parts of the world where they're actually seeing a shrinking population. Some degree of immigration, I think, is probably a good thing. And that's why I say I wouldn't cut off immigration. I would simply cut it by about two-thirds.
I've never quite been able to understand the concept that somehow America has been the melting pot, but I think the pot is full. And that those of us who look at these questions from a almost scientific perspective realize that we're reaching a limit here. I guess we could continue, but the question is that going to serve us well? Is that going to really add to our quality of life? What's the balance as the population really continues to increase?
Right, and I think people have a very poor understanding of where we're at. I think most Americans, if you ask them questions about what is the population of the United States, say, or what should it be, they would be fairly clueless about it. But interestingly enough, in surveys, most Americans are opposed to high immigration levels, and this crosses all racial and ethnic boundaries. If you were to ask African Americans or Hispanic Americans that question, they'd be similarly opposed to high immigration levels. And in a way, it stands to reason. If you're a population that has economic difficulties, you don't want to see enormous amounts of competition for available jobs. And that is what generations of African-American leaders have said. And yet, we have these very, very high immigration levels. And again, I would say that largely it serves business interests.
business, money, stuff, economics, development, expansion, retirement, markets, tax breaks, investments. Where do we go from here? We'll continue our discussion following this brief and important announcement.
Come on up for the rising. Come on up with your heads in line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising line. Left the house this morning. Bells were ringing, felt the air. I was wearing the cross of my calling. Home wheels of fire.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.